Welcome to Local Talk Live on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host today, Susan Franzen, with
Tom Beal.
And we are giving you the post-election coverage for both Ames and Story County. Our election in Ames was Mayor Ann Campbell with 96%. If you went online, you would know that. At large, Amber Corrieri won over Ann Kinsel. Out of 4,457 votes, the margin was only 109 votes. So it was really a very close
election.
It
was an intense campaign for both candidates.
Yes.
So it turned out the voters.
It did. And Ward 1, Gloria Betcher won with 193 margin out of 1425, which is also pretty close. She beat Justin Dodge by just that narrow margin. And Tim Garten was the unopposed candidate in Ward 2, and he got 85%. There were 202 write-ins. Tom, you had something to say about that this morning. There was a last-minute write-in challenge?
There was a last-minute. It came in really too late for the candidate to have a chance, but there was a feeling that there shouldn't be an open race, that every position should have a competition, a choice for voters.
Well, but Tim was also a first-time candidate. Now, Ward 3 was incumbent, Peter Arazem, and he was unopposed. He got 97% of the vote out of 627, so not much of a turnout in his ward. Ward 4 had the highest turnout. That's my ward, so I really paid attention, about 20% of the registered voters. And in that, with 994 votes, Chris Nelson won over Victoria Shapinski by a margin of 61.
Amazing, isn't it? And another reminder of how every vote counts. And that, too, was a race with a lot of energy on both sides wanting to make that successful. You know, the turnout was, as you said, maybe only 20% of registered voters, but it was a rainy day and gloomy and dark and windy, and it sometimes takes some energy for people to get out and do their patriotic duty, which is to vote.
Well, let's look around the county. Cambridge mayor is incumbent Scott DeYoung. The Collins mayor, another incumbent, is Brett Cominges. The Colo mayoral race had no candidates, so that was a write-in. And Gilbert has an incumbent who won again, Jonathan C. Pop. Huxley, again an incumbent, Craig Henry. Kelly, all write-ins, no candidate. And same for Maxwell, no, all write-ins, no candidate. McCallsburg had Wallace Loney, who is an incumbent. Nevada mayor, that was a real race. There were three candidates. Lynn Lathrop won with 61% of the vote, only 419 votes count. I mean, only 419
cast, yeah.
Votes cast. Andrew Murphy also ran, and Rhonda Applegate. And the Roland mayor was 49 write-ins. So
wow.
That was also a write-in campaign. The Slater mayor, that was a real race. And I happen to know both candidates. I'll talk about that in a minute. Gary Halverson won over Howard Hammond by only 11 votes.
Once again, how important every vote can be.
Right, of 401 votes cast. And Story City, Michael Jensen, also an incumbent, Zaring Jim Chance Jr.
Well, incumbents frequently have a big advantage over challengers. In Ames, we had so many fresh, or open seats, rather, that it made for a different campaign and maybe encouraged some people to turn out who wouldn't have otherwise. You know, I think it's really important to acknowledge and to commend the people in the smaller towns in particular who are willing to step up and run for office and help to serve the community by serving in office. It's something that we could easily cast off and not do, but they did, and so we should say thanks to them.
Oh, yes. I think anyone, yes, it's a really difficult job. Anyone who's gone to city council meetings in Ames probably thinks, I mean, I have certainly thought, just to sit through those is such a great citizen's task.
Right.
But I'd also like to make a little a comment about the county elections, because I have a special soft spot for the mayors of these towns, because the summer before we went on the air, Ursula Rudenberg asked me to go around and get 30-second sound clips from the mayors saying, "This is Mayor so-and-so welcoming KHOI into our area." She said, "And while you're out there, get 10-minute interviews from them." And I was so impressed with every mayor I interviewed, what enthusiasm they had for their towns, how distinct and different each town was in its challenges and what they were doing, their strengths. And it's not like all these little towns are dying. No, not at all.
Lots of energy out there.
Lots of energy.
Before we conclude our discussion of the election, I wanted to say a word about the election officials. These are everyday people who agree to run the election, the precincts where the votes are cast. They get there very early in the morning, and they stay there until late in the evening. And they are paid, but not very much. And they are doing a real service for us.
Our program today will be centered on a special event that's taking place right here in our neighborhood, right next door. It's the grand opening of the new Ames History Center in the building of the Ames Historical Society, which will be from 1 to 7 this afternoon, Wednesday, November the 4th. And we have Kathy Sveck, co-chair of the board of the Ames Historical Society, to tell us about it.
Hi, Kathy. Would you introduce yourself, please?
Well, I am Kathy Sveck, and I am currently the co-president of the Ames Historical Society and have been involved with the organization since 1989, when I came onto the board.
And what was the Ames Historical Society like at that time?
Well, it was a very, very small organization. It really consisted mostly of just the board members. By that time, Hoggett School had been restored, and there was programming and activities involving Hoggett School. But the organization sort of existed in a shoebox that traveled from closet to closet as the board leadership changed. And they were meeting at the time I joined the board at Wilson Beercher School, because Lee Hyman, who was on the board, was the principal there, and he provided that meeting space. So it was a very low-profile organization, and it had a lot of growing to do in 1989.
Well, did you have your own building? At what time did you even rent space?
Well, the organization was just established in 1980, so it was relatively new in 1989 when I joined the board. The organization existed as that sort of shoebox organization until 1999, at which time we rented space in the Octagon. It's the space that now is occupied by the community gallery. And we rented that space to present exhibits, because we felt that if the community was ever going to support the establishment of a historical museum for the community, they needed to see what it could do. So we established that facility at 417 Douglas, right across the street from where we are now, as a demonstration museum.
We've had links with the Historical Society. Our building has had links with the Historical Society for decades. Is that correct?
Yes, it has. Now, the organization was founded by Farwell Brown. And Farwell was the Ames historian. He retired from the DOT in 1974, and in 1976. And his interest actually in local history didn't really start until that time. He was the grandson of two pioneer families, the Browns and the Tildens, who had been in Ames within about 5 years of the time that Ames was established in 1864. So they were very, very early, and they were people who saved things and people who understood the value of historical things. And So Farwell inherited those family albums and family collections, but it was sort of old hat to him, you know, growing up in Ames. It just didn't seem that interesting to him, but after he retired, people began asking him if he would do programs on Ames history. And 1976 was the American Bicentennial, and so all things historical were being promoted. And Farwell began giving little talks around town based on his the family albums from those two families. So we still have recordings of Farwell doing the Ames album based on those family photographs.
So a little history, local history about local history, right?
There you go. There you go. So at the time I stepped on the board, it was about Farwell's last year on the board. And so after that, he became more of an advisor and a guardian angel to our efforts. But 1989 marked the 125th anniversary of the founding of Ames. And so we did present a major quasquicentennial exhibit at the Octagon that year. And so that was really the start of our activities in trying to exhibit local history to community residents.
Well, after the Octagon, where did you go?
Well, we opened in 1999 as the Demonstration Museum. And by the end of 2 years, 2001, we were beginning to run pretty thin on human resources because it took a lot of energy. We really wanted to present a lot of exhibits, which we did, but it took its toll both on our human resources and on our financial resources. And so we felt like we really had to close. We just knew that we were going to run out of just everything that we had. And there was a sad announcement in the paper, and about a week after that, a local landlord came forward and offered us a space at a very, very modest and affordable rent right around the corner at 108 Fifth Street. And we're indebted to Bob Cody for providing that space to us because it really allowed us to transition to the form that we took today. So we moved around the corner to 108 Fifth Street, and we changed our focus. We thought that we had better start amassing a collection. And by this time, Dennis Wendell had retired from the ISU library, and he is was a wonderful archivist, and he really created the structure to organize the things that we began taking. And he's a longtime Ames person and knew who to go out and tap, who had the goods, who had the things that any museum representing the city of Ames should have. And so at 108 Fifth Street, we really shifted our focus to begin collecting things in a pretty serious way. Then, as you can well imagine, we began to run out of space at 108 Fifth Street. And in 2006, we formed a little committee to begin looking at spaces. Where should a future Ames Museum be housed? And we had a wonderful committee consisting of local realtors and other people who would be able to help us in a substantive way. And we looked at maybe 15 to 20 different spaces all over the community. And the space that we found to be to offer the most amenities and the most practical needs that any museum has was the new building at 5th and Douglas, 416. And ironically, it is a brand new building, not very historical, although on a very historical site, but it fulfilled the needs that any contemporary museum has to store collections and present programs.
Now, what are those needs that are special? Why, for example, I've heard the library, the old original Carnegie Library was offered to you, and you rejected it. So what does this building have?
Well, we didn't reject it. It was taken away, shall we say. There was a thought early on in the library renovation that there would be a completely new library built on the south side of the Carnegie Addition, and that the Carnegie Building could be reused. But in the course of forming a plan for the expansion of the library, they decided to reuse the Carnegie Building. So we did not reject that. It would have been a lovely space for us. The archival collections are stored on sturdy metal shelving. and they weigh thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds. So you need a floor that is structurally strong. And the space at 416 Douglas is, or the building, is built on a thick concrete slab. And so it provides the structural support that's necessary for shelving and archival storage. We can also control the temperature and the climate. And there is an elevator that works, which is very nice. Structure of 416 Douglas is open span, meaning there are just a few supports down the middle, but the space can be completely opened up so that it can function as an exhibition area at some future moment in time. The roof on 416 Douglas is a metal, long-lasting roof, and so we felt that we could put our resources into collections and programming rather than pouring hundreds of thousands of dollars into trying to shore up a building that was falling apart. So it was practical, and we realized it's not glamorous or historical, but it did allow us to focus on our primary mission.
The reason we're having this program today is because this is a big day at the Ames
Historical Society. Yes.
And I think, are you changing your name?
Well, we are naming the facility. And the facility is the Ames History Center, run by the Ames Historical Society. And it has become a sort of an industry standard among museum professionals to call their facilities history centers. And we feel like this is a broad term that incorporates not only collections and exhibitions, but also programming and research and all the functions that modern history centers provide to the community. So we are naming the facility the Ames History Center.
Well, I know that when people go there with a historical question, that you have staff to help them. Is that right?
That is right. We have six staff persons. Now, that may sound like a lot, but only one of them is full-time. So we are still building staff, but we are very pleased to have a three-quarter time administrative assistant, a half-time curator, and several other more part-time persons, a research assistant and a jack-of-all-trades ISU student that we're very glad to have.
We also have a few volunteers. Is that correct?
Many, many wonderful, amazing volunteers. Amazing.
I have a question about the history of that site. You mentioned that it was on a historic site. Now, if I went to the Historical Center and said, I want to find out about the Ames Hotel, which I happen to know. I remember the Ames Hotel. And one of the things that's fun for me, living in Ames as long as I have, 50 years, is that I've seen buildings morph, spaces morph into something different.
Mm-hmm.
And the old Ames Hotel, I remember, and I knew one of its last owners who had great affection for it, and I think was sad when it was torn down. So I'd like to know something about the history of the building that preceded this modern building.
Well, some of those very, very early pictures of the block between Main and Douglas and then the block between 5th and 6th on Douglas, there are pictures that show residential homes all in that block. And, of course, the Adams Funeral Home was the residence of Wallace and Mary Greeley. And so it was actively a residential block early in Ames history. And this site at 5th and Douglas was no exception. It was the home of a dentist named Charles Hunt. And he came to Ames sometime in the 1870s and built that fairly large home right there on the corner. And he was interested in starting a dental practice. And so he apprenticed himself to the very first dentist that had been practicing in Ames and then eventually bought the practice. So in Dr. Hunt's home, the first floor was his dental practice, and then the other floors were his family residence. And he practiced until he died in 1919. And at that time, his home began being used for other purposes. Now, I'm not exactly sure when it became the Ames Hotel, but it did function in that way up until just a few years before it was torn down for the construction of the current building. So the History Center building was built in 1993. So the Ames Hotel, the former home of Dr. Hunt, existed probably until the late 1980s or early 1990s.
Well, one of the characteristics of that hotel that I will just mention because I remember it, and I now understand why it had it, being originally a residence, it had a wraparound veranda.
Yes.
So the people, and my friend Carol Ryerson, who was one of the late owners, last owners of that hotel, used to recall sitting on the porch. And he really enjoyed living in the hotel. And in fact, if there's anyone listening who either has memories of the Ames Hotel or knows of someone who does, you could email khoitalk, T-A-L-K, at gmail.com, and we'll follow up on that. So this is a way of sort of building, collecting some more history.
about this historical site,
if
not about this rather plain building that sits there now. But it would be very fun to know a little bit more about the Ames Hotel. But we are certainly excited to be in this spot. When the site committee was selecting 416 Douglas as an appropriate building for expansion as an Ames History Center, the location across from both the Octagon Center for the Arts and the Ames Public Library, and of course the historic home of Wallace and Mary Greeley, it just seemed like the perfect location. And now, of course, with the addition of KHOI, we feel like the cultural corridor is right here on between Main and Fifth on Douglas. And we are very excited for the library to be back and to be functioning as a resource right beside the library for people who want information of various kinds.
So it's very convenient. And it is convenient for us as we develop a little more time to do research.
Exactly.
Welcome to Local Live Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Tom Beal, and today Susan Franzen and I are hosting a program honoring the opening of the Ames History Center in the building of the Ames Historical Society. Susan has been talking to Kathy Sweck about the development of the Ames Historical Society from its beginnings in the scrapbooks and photographs of Farwell Brown. Now we'll continue with Kathy's description of what Douglas Avenue and downtown Ames looked like in the past, followed by a preview of the Ames Historical Center, as you'll find it if you visit the grand opening Wednesday afternoon between 1 p.m. and 7 p.m.
That's today. It seems quite ironic that you are the History Center and we have the historic building, even though we've only been here 2 years.
I know.
But it's part of this morphing. And originally, what was the Octagon?
It was originally a multi-purpose building. It was built by Wallace Greeley, and the top floor was built to house the Masonic Temple. And you can, when you are up in that main gallery, you can still get a sense of that Masonic temple function with the balcony and the very high ceiling. The other two floors were the Collegiate Manufacturing Company, which had started as a part of the Tilden store and then grew into its own separate business, manufacturing college pennants and blankets and beanies and mascot animals and all sorts of college-related memorabilia. And they occupied the ground and second floor.
Wow, that's interesting. I remember it in a different location, so it's interesting for me to know that it used to be right there on Douglas.
Right down on Douglas. And as a matter of fact, the Lechner Building, the building immediately to the west, was linked by a second-story hallway. And the Collegiate Manufacturing Company expanded into the Lechner Building and occupied part of that space for a period of time. So it was quite a going small industry right in downtown Ames at the time that it was functioning there.
Oh, well, someone said to me that this was the center of the original town of Ames, and I'm not quite sure what that means. Do you have any reflection on that? In what sense would that be true?
Well, the very first depot stood right immediately south of Main Street at Duff, about where the Dutch Oven Bakery stands today. That was the location of the very first depot in Ames. And so the Main Street really grew from that spot west. So that 100 block was the first of the commercial buildings that were built in downtown Ames. Now, in addition to that, the very first home in Ames was built on the spot where Wallace and Mary built their home. So the Webster family had a small frame structure right on the corner of 5th and Douglas. And when the Greeleys decided that they wanted to build their house there, they didn't just knock the house down, they moved it. And it still exists over on Crawford Street. Now, it's been, you know, it has new siding on it. It looks like a contemporary home, but inside is a very, very old home. And as I said before, those first blocks originally were residential streets. The earliest pictures of the Ames Public Library that opened in 1904, on the edges of those pictures, you can see houses on both sides of it, both on the Douglas side and the 6th Street side. So everything kind of grew west from that intensive block where the depot was and the site where the State Farm Agency is on Main and Duff was the site of yet another Ames Hotel, so named. And it serviced people coming off the train, and all they had to do was to get off at the depot and then just cross the street. And there was a hotel and also a livery service that would rent you a fine horse and carriage. So that is really the very intensive commercial and residential area where Ames started.
And is Cynthia Duff's house somewhere in there, too?
Cynthia actually lived on a farm north of 13th Street. And as far as we know, there are no remnants left of any of the structures that Cynthia and her husband built. Although she ran a small restaurant in one of the commercial buildings on Main Street, but that has been torn down, and it's the little pass-through that goes from Main to the parking lots behind right at Douglas. And so that's called Cynthia Duff Plaza because Cynthia ran a little restaurant in the building that used to be there.
Okay. Well, that's why I had seen the Cynthia Duff Plaza sign, and I didn't realize it was her business rather than her home.
Right.
So, well, what are the changes that we're going to see today when we visit the Ames History Center.
Yes. Well, first of all, you will come in the main front door. Now, up until our renovation, we were using a little side door that was sort of over near the Pantorium, and now we're using the main front entrance. We've installed these fabulous window films showcasing some vintage images from Ames in the windows, so we're using our windows as exhibit areas. You'll come in the front door, and we're using the main hallway straight ahead of the front door as exhibition space, so you can linger for quite a long time out in the hallway and look at interpreted artifacts in display cases. And the staff has prepared a series of aerial pictures taken of Ames in different time periods, and those are pictures you can stare at for hours. There is so much detail. But after you browse the exhibits in the hallway, you can come into the main door, and we change the door from a solid metal door to glass so that you can see in and see a welcoming face, the receptionist right inside the door, and our little shop. Little sales shop is right inside the front door, as well as some of our most frequently used reference materials. The rest of the space right inside the front door is exhibition and programming space. So when we get a request from a group for a program for maybe up to 30 or 40 people, we can set chairs and have that program right in our building. Prior to this, we've had to find other space. We've used the Octagon quite a bit, and we used the library when it was across the street, but we didn't have enough space right in our building to sit down and have a presentation to a group. So we're very, very excited to be able to do that in our own space. Now, toward the middle of our space, and this is the whole first floor now, will be completely ours. So in the center part of the first floor is the workroom for staff and volunteers and the office for our director. And then next to the director's office is the Struss Media Room, named after Raleigh and Willie Struss, who established the oral history program. And it will continue to be a comfortable space to record oral histories. And we have accumulated quite a few recordings now. And so you can stop in and settle into a comfortable couch and watch watch and listen to videos and tapes of people talking about the things they remember about growing up in Ames. And then the south third of the floor is our archive space, and it was completely redone to meet museum standards. And we are thrilled to have this very, very state-of-the-art space in which to store our precious historical documents. And we were able to double the storage space that we had previous to this. So after the open house, the archives room really will not be accessible to the public. So our open house is really going to be a great chance to see what the archives look like and the types of things that we have in our collection. Now, I want to hastily say that that is not the only storage space. We have additional space in multiple locations around town where we store our collection, and our long-term goal is to bring all those things under one roof. But that is going to take a little more time and a few more resources than we have today. But we are so excited to be taking the step that we're taking today in opening the History Center and having more space to function.
For those listening today to our live program or to the recorded sections that will be aired at noon and 7, I guess 7's a little late to get over and see the your hours are what, 1 to 7 today?
1 to 7, and we're going to have a Chamber of Commerce ribbon cutting at 3 p.m., and there will be light refreshments throughout the day and hosts and hostesses just to tour you around and through the space. So drop in anytime. And we really, really hope that the community will begin to understand that we do have a growing and engaged history resource right here in downtown Ames.
And for those who can't make it today, what are your regular hours?
Well, starting next Monday, we are going to actually expand our hours. We're going to be open every afternoon, Monday through Friday, from 1 to 5. And so being open every day during the normal working week is an expansion of our hours. And there will always be someone there to help or to host.
That sounds like a great addition to Ames, and I hope that those listening today will stop over and begin to get excited about what has inspired you for all these years.
Well, and the staff has been working very hard to create some new exhibits for our new exhibit space in the History Center. So what we hope is that you'll come and you'll learn something you just did not know about your city prior to this. And we hope to continue presenting those wonderful surprises about the history of Ames.
And we hope to be in touch with you and share some of those on our morning show.
Well, thanks for having me today, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kathy.
Well, you're listening to KHOI-FM 89.1, serving Story City and Ames and surrounding communities.
At Kathy's suggestion, we've just been listening to Kathy. Excuse me, can't edit that out. We've just been listening to Kathy Sveck, the co-president of the Ames Historical Society Board and longtime supporter of history of Ames. At her suggestion, we went to one of the founding members of the Ames Historical Society, who's still with us, Terry Adams. He's very much with us and a real friend of KHOI. And one of those founding, like Farwell Brown, who was a founder, he is from a pioneer family. But he's best known for his association with a historic building, the Adams Funeral Home, which is another one of our neighbors. He also is dear to the hearts of all of us at KHOI for reasons you will hear in a few minutes in his interview. Now, Tom, you've interviewed him before, haven't you?
Yes, I have. And Terry is such a fixture, you might say, in Ames, not only because his family has been associated with this historic funeral home in downtown Ames, but because, as you pointed out, he's a member of a founding family, and his family has had much to do with the growth and development of Ames over the decades, if not the century.
Well, let's hear what he has to say.
Well, Farwell Brown actually was the power behind that, and I knew Farwell, and I've always been interested in history. I'm part of the fourth generation of Adams family in Ames, so history just caught my attention right away. Frankly, history is the area of my interest back in school, so I've always kind of stuck with that and did all I could to find out more about Ames history. When Farwell got that going, that was a good way to kick in and help put things together, I think.
I'm here today because you have become part of Ames history. You have something that is extremely rare. You can actually remember what it was like in that Adams house, which I guess previously was the Greeley Mansion. Could you tell us a little about that house?
I'll go back to how we got into it. My grandfather had started a furniture and undertaking business, and he was located on the south side of Main Street. Initial location, I believe, is 302 Main Street, which is now the Pumpkin Patch. I think of it as the Eschbach Music House. That dates me, too. And then what's now the town center building on the southeast corner of Burnett and Main was initially a livery stable. That's where he got his horses to draw the hearse for funerals. But when they gave up the livery stable, he ended up moving down there and rebuilding the thing and put the funeral home or the business, furniture and undertaking business in there. And after a period of time, he decided he wanted to build a place. And before he got started on that, the Greeley House, of course, had the Greeleys were gone, and it had been a fraternity, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, I believe. And they, all of a sudden, they wanted to move all the students out to the campus, live out in that area. So it went up for sale, and he gave up the idea of building because he thought it'd make a good funeral home. So he bought the building and moved in there. It was the funeral home.
Do you remember when you took your dry cleaning or your laundry to the Ames Panatorium?
Oh, yeah. Went in there regularly for that situation and got all my dress shirts cleaned there, or washed there. I got my suits cleaned, and I'd pick them up. I had good service, and I remember that real well. The corner just beyond, and then there was the alley, and just beyond that was, at one time, the gas company. Iowa Electric, they called it, but it's the gas company, and I dropped my utility bills off in a little slot. Well, of course, that's not there anymore. They got that situation moved. And then going just west of the, just right west across Douglas, that big three-story building, Masonic Temple on the top floor, Collegiate Manufacturing used to be there. My dad's older brother, Sheb, was president of that company. He bought it when it was Tilden Manufacturing against my grandfather's recommendation. He says, you can't make money at that. Well, Chev expanded it quite a bit. I started working for Collegiate just before my seventh grade year in school. I was out in the yard at the funeral home. I'd been doing work. George Grooms came kitty corner across the street and asked me if I wanted a job. And I said, well, I have one. Well, he offered me a little more money. And their cap blocker had quit working so he could try out for football, high school football, early. And, of course, that's a prime time to get everything done, to get it sent off to the colleges for the beginning of the school year. So I went down there and started blocking camps, and I ended up working at collegiate from just before my seventh grade year, actually, until a couple of years after I graduated from college, in summers only.
So we're really happy to be in your neighborhood, and you still feel sort of like it's in your neighborhood, I understand.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes I stop in there and thank him for the broadcasting that comes. I've got my radios tuned in. I switched from 90.1 to 89.1 because I like what they have. I have my what they call a clock radio upstairs. Instead of setting on the alarm, I just set for the radio to come on in the morning to get up in time. And I love the music in the morning. That's a much more pleasant thing than hearing the buzz of an alarm.
Well, if you're up as early as 7 tomorrow morning, this morning when this goes on the air, you'll hear your voice.
Okay, that's good, except unfortunately, tomorrow morning I have a 7 o'clock meeting at the country club.
Okay, well, that's why you couldn't be with us live, isn't that right?
Right, because I was a charter member of the Ames Morning Rotary Club, and we got it organized, and I thought, well, it's all done, and then the new club members elected me a charter president, so I stayed there for that reason. Then we get done just about 8 o'clock, and by then, of course, the program's over. So
tomorrow you can listen in at noon and hear yourself. Well, thank you very much, Terry. It's been wonderful to get to meet you and listen to you tomorrow morning.
I'll do that.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Welcome to Local Talk Live on KHOI Community Radio. Today, Susan Franson and I are hosting a program honoring the opening of the Ames History Center. All the discussion today has been about our neighborhood, with a special stress on the way buildings and their uses have changed over the years. Now we'd like to take some time with this history of the building that means the most to us, the Pantorium.
This is Ursula Rudenberg, our general manager, who found this building and through a most serendipitous manner.
Well, in the summer of 2011, hi Susan, hi Tom. in the summer of 2011, the project that was KHOI, at that time we were trying to get on the air, and we were located at the First Baptist Church. And they very generously gave us quite a bit of space up there. But it became clear that in order to launch the station, we really needed a campaign headquarters that was very accessible to the public and that gave us a public front or a public facade. And what better building than the Pantorium? Is an iconic building here in Ames. And so, among other people, I was going around town trying to figure out where would be the headquarters for KHOI, where would we put the radio station. And I noticed that the Pantorium building was empty at the time and just kept looking at it and thinking, wow, you know, the Pantorium would be the awesomest of all buildings to have, and really didn't think that it would be possible. I just assumed it wasn't accessible. And I was speaking with my younger sister, Annette, who lives in Minneapolis now, but she grew up in Ames as well as I did. And when Annette was in high school, this was in the mid-70s, 1970s, she did not go to Ames High School. Ames High School had a what they called
an alternative school.
Yeah, exactly. It was an alternative school for people that didn't want to go to the high school. It was a free school of sorts where students could direct their own curriculum. And it was located here in the Pantorium on the second floor. And this was the dry cleaners was still on the first floor. And the second floor is a relatively large space. And that's where the Ames Alternative High School was. And a lot of staff from Youth and Shelter Services were providing teachers, and it was actually a really great run that lasted maybe 2 or 3 years, and then the whole thing kind of ended again. So, but my sister was there at the time, and I was painting a mural down here on what used to be Mondo's, which is now Whiskey River, and so I was around a lot, too, so I would go up there a lot, and there was a whole scene up there, a very creative and young people and older people working with them. And so anyway, I called up my sister last on the summer of 2011, and I said, oh, you know, the Pantorium building's empty. Wouldn't that be wonderful if we could have the radio station there? And Annette is one of these people who just, you know, she's very has a very persuasive mentality. So she said, you have to go down there right now. We got to do the Pantorium because that's where the energy is from the alternative school. And you just like get in your car right now. It was a Sunday afternoon. Get in your car right now and drive down there and just go to that building. And so I said, okay. So I got in my car for no apparent reason, and I drove down the Pantorium, and I looked in the window, and the landlord, Dennis Jones, and his wife, Cindy, were in here, and they were painting the walls, and I think they were working on the ceiling. And the place was kind of a construction site, and I was just peering in the window, and Dennis saw me and very nicely came over and opened the door and said, who are you? And I introduced myself, and I said, you know, I would love to make this a community space. And I didn't think he would take me seriously, and he did. And so I told him what we wanted to do. He was not unreceptive to it. And so I called him up a week later, and I said, Dennis, would you meet me down at Cafe Diem and have a serious talk about it? And he showed up, and we talked about it, and he said he would give it serious thought. And he actually had some other offers for people that wanted to do other things in the building. But he was very generous with us, and he, I think he shared this vision of a community space. And so he did continue talking to us, and in the fall of 2011, we moved in here. And we could not ask for a better landlord. He's an absolute dream landlord.
You know, the Pantorium sign still remains outside the building, and it's a historic sign, so we want to keep it. But it does confuse a few people who think the cleaners are still operating here. We've had people come in the front door with armloads of clothing wanting to have it cleaned, and we have to tell them, no, it's a radio station, but we do broadcast the cleanest programming in town.
And we do once. We should air dirty laundry. No, we actually do.
Well,
but it's absolutely true. It's a regular event that people come in here with their clothes, and it's funny because some people walk in, and even though they can see that obviously it's something else, they still say to us, "Well, where do I put my laundry?" And but the sad thing is when people come in and say they want to pick up their laundry.
Yeah, from who knows, 15, 20 years ago.
And that does happen quite a bit. It's interesting. Dennis showed me the basement of the building, and there is actually a machine downstairs in the building, which really we should move next door because it's a phenomenal-looking machine. I think it was to press pants. And there's a fur vault in the basement. And I didn't even know there were enough people in Ames that wore fur coats to warrant a fur vault. But there is one down there.
Wow. Well, that's a wonderful story. And we just happened to have from last spring an interview that I did with Dennis to give some sense of what a terrific landlord he is and what a great person to work with.
Yeah, and we really have to give a shout out to Dennis because Dennis yes. is just there could not be a more wonderful landlord. He's been so generous and helpful.
Well, we'll play as much of that interview as we can before we run out of time. So would you like to start it, please?
Why did you decide to buy the Pantorium?
Well, I've been involved in Friends of Central Isle Biking for a number of years as one of the founders of it. And we'd been fixing up bicycles and selling them for cheap transportation and family bicycles around town for several years. And we got out of that when we really didn't have a place to work on bicycles. So I was looking toward retirement for a place to putter some and have a place that we could work as a bike club on bicycles. And the Pantorium one day had a for sale sign in the window, and I looked into it and decided that was time to do something, and it had an area at the back that looked just about right for that. So
you basically bought it for the garage, right?
Pretty much for the garage and the fact that I just loved the looks of the building and had always, you know, we had, as a family here in Ames, we had taken our clothes to the Ames Pantorium for a number of years and knew what it was and just looked like a cool thing.
So you were also taken by the historic preservation aspect.
Oh, yes. I'm an agricultural engineer in the structures group, and just have always practiced a little bit of building structures and architectural type of things related to my work. And I'm also a little bit of a history buff, so that kind of tied everything all together for me.
Well, you can answer a question that I have wondered about a lot. I was told that your work was related in some way to the things you'd be doing here, and I couldn't figure out what at the USDA you would be doing that would have anything to do with building. And you said now architecture and...
Well, I'm the facility engineer out there, so while the new facilities were built, I actually transferred to headquarters and worked to help manage the construction and the contractors while they built the National Centers for Animal Health that are out on 13th and Dayton. So I've been involved with roughly $500 million worth of construction in the last 10 years here in town. So
when you bought the Pantorium, what was your idea?
I saw a building that needed some help and some nurturing, and I anticipate retiring here in a few years. And when I do that, this is going to be my project to bring back to life and help bring back to the community as well. So,
well, things have taken off a little since you originally bought it and it was sitting empty. Could you tell how you got hooked up with KHOI?
Yes. Well, the leaser at the time that I bought it was Huxley Cleaners, and they were using it for a drop-off and a pickup for their cleaning business. And so when I bought into it, I assumed over the next 2 years of lease that looked about just about right for when I was planning to retire. And so that seemed to all fit together. And unfortunately, they weren't able to economically make it at that point, and so they abandoned the lease. And then my wife and I started fixing it up and tore out some of the 1960s, I believe, mahogany paneling that was put in the front room and the suspended ceiling. And we found the old tin ceiling above it, and we're really enjoying what we were finding. And as we were doing that and working one Saturday morning, Ursula came up to the window, put her hands around so she could see in, and stood out there kind of wondering what was going on. And we invited her in and got to talking about her interest and use of the building and so on. And at that point, we had talked with a couple possibilities for renting, but didn't have anything nailed down. And the whole project just enthused me as well. Roger Parmenter, who was one of your founders as well, had been out to our Kiwanis meeting sometime before that, maybe 6 or 8 months ahead of that, and was talking about KHOI and the fact that they were establishing, getting ready to go. So whatever it was that brought us together, it just kind of all fell together and it worked out very well.
Local Talk Live on KHOI Community Radio. This show was produced by Ursula Rudenberg and engineered by Richard Morrison. Local Talk Live is engineered by Richard Morrison. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Now, we'd like to take some time to say goodbye to you all. And we are so appreciative for your listening. Your participation as audience is what makes KHO possible. If you like us, tell your friends. If you really like us, we'd appreciate contributions. This is getting toward the end of the year when a lot of people think about their tax-deductible end-of-year contributions. Please put us on your short list. We have... A goal now for if we had 500 families who contributed $250 each, we would be able to make our operating expenses comfortably, and that would be our terrific goal. And we have a few families to go, so like 400, right?
And you don't have to pay the full amount up at one time. Many families are contributing $20 a month, and that amount can really help us.
Thank you for listening, and see you
on
again.
The radio.
See you again on the radio.
Oh, I missed the line, didn't I?
We're probably off the air anyway.